Park Place meeting, talk given Tuesday morning, 17th of May, 1977. As you all know, the theme is Holy Day. And it would be well for us to consider the meanings of the word day first. The obvious meaning, of course, for the whole world is the daytime, as well as the 24-hour period, which we call one day. And that meaning is determined by the movement of the earth to rotate once on its own axis. Note carefully, it rotates once on its own axis in 24 hours. That's the day, the whole day as we call it, which includes what we call the night, so that we have a period of the day where there is light and a period of the day which remains dark. And it is interesting to remember very carefully that the period of light, including fading light, the twilight, is always longer on the whole, taking the whole year, than the period of dark. We forget that all too often. Well, that is the ordinary matter-of-fact meaning of the day and daytime and night. Again, we may regard the day from another point of view. Any occasion which becomes lighted up for us through the presence of someone who is special who is extraordinary who by his presence exercises an inspiring influence by his presence or his actions he may be a great artist who performs or something like that. Well, that lights up our day for us. And it is like daytime, whatever the time of the whole 24-hour day may be. If that person happens to be one whom we call a holy one, a realized being, one who radiates the influence of personality which has itself realized the purpose of his existence. Then there is a breakthrough into our own awareness of the nature of the sacred. The sacred in the true sense, not in its limited sense. In its limited sense, it is we ourselves who spin out our idea of the sacred through our worldly experience. And that idea of the sacred is not the sacred, because this idea grows out of the past, out of the known, out of our observation of things external to us or arising within us through our own imagination and so forth. None of these things belong to that realm of transcendence which is immortal and immeasurable. None of these things belong to that realm of the unknown and unknowable which cannot be touched by mortality. That's our ordinary idea of the sacred. But that which is the sacred, truly, the holy, is something quite other than anything that the brain can spin out. That pure essence of mind within us, embodied in us, hidden in us, which in Kabbalistic terms, Judaic terms, is called neshama, that is something in us which at times is touched by this other than ordinary sacred. Then that is truly the sacred. And the presence of a Holy One who has really realized holiness enables that to flash through and touch our inner being. And that is an experience of day. The sun of enlightenment, if you like, which suddenly flares up inside us. And then, unfortunately, it gets hidden over again by the cloud of our ordinary existential being and processes. There is another meaning also. The day represents our conscious life, just as the night represents, the dark represents our subconscious life and process. Again, when there is a real stir of wisdom from the inner depths of our being, and it is something which happens naturally and spontaneously, when there is that inner stir of wisdom emerging out of the dark depth of the subconscious or the unconscious, call it what you like, into clear comprehension, then that is day. One sees truth. And you will have noticed that when we have such experience, it is a seeing which is free of thought coverings. It is free of concepts. It is free of verbal formulation. But there is very clear comprehension, and the meaning of the word comprehension here is something obviously beyond comprehension in the dictionary sense of the word. We express this otherness of this profound comprehension by the phrase, "That's it, I've got it." But you don't really know it in the ordinary sense of the word knowing, because it is still free of concepts and words. Afterwards, immediately almost, concepts and words will arise. But that sudden moment, I see it, is the moment before concepts and words have come to contain within the realm of our ordinary psychical finitude that which belongs to the infinite and to the realm of pure universal mind. These are very difficult things to talk about, because as you appreciate, there is no possibility of talking or formulating verbally without having concepts which one hands over in a particular language. This is the only means by which we can communicate. And here the word communicate is correct. If and when we can utterly transcend the necessity for communication, then we have true communion. You have to sort of feel the difference. And if you can feel it in fullness, anytime, anywhere, without striving to feel it, that's very important, then suddenly you will say, "Yes, I see it." See, all this belongs to a psychological depth, a region which the intellectual who investigates psychology never touches. He doesn't know what we are trying to consider together. Doesn't know it at all. If the conventional psychologist, however brilliant, however profound, were to understand this, were to know about it, he would understand the meaning of that extraordinary statement in the Buddhist texts that after the enlightenment, the Buddha stood 7 days and nights, staring at the roots of the tree of enlightenment. We have talked about this on previous occasions at our group meetings and so on. Think over it carefully. We have to start by thinking over it. 7 days and nights staring at the roots of a tree. Even the most enthusiastic botanist couldn't or wouldn't do it. So you see the significance of that kind of statement. When enlightenment has truly come into the full blaze of the noonday sun, so to say, then that psyche is a completely purified psyche, a phenomenon which is rare in every century. Who knows about it? Who can talk about it? One might say only another enlightened one knows about it and talks about it. But when two such enlightened beings meet each other, they don't need to talk about it at all. Because this state of the psyche, which is utterly purified, is one which offers no barriers to completely free communion between pure psyche and pure psyche, through which the reality, the truth, the light of universal mind flows through unobstructed by the living bodily person. This is something which slowly is emerging through this kingdom of nature which we call the human kingdom. Very slowly emerging. People ask sometimes, what is the purpose of our existence? If we can begin to understand something of this, if the least little ray of light, even if it is just twilight, were to come through into us, we will have no doubts whatsoever. No feeling of uncertainty as to the value of each one of us and the divine purpose, a divine purpose for which each one of us exists in the world. So, when one is fully enlightened, then one is in constant communion. And as I have already said, two enlightened beings don't need to talk to each other about this. There is a very important and serious point connected with this. When religious knowledge in this deep and profound sense impels, or rather I should say, when the call of this deep and profound religious knowledge impels a seeker, a beginner, to go and search for the enlightened one, he searches in a state of illusion. I need not mention names, but you know how in our century people from what are in worldly terms called the developed countries have gone out to India or other places to search for and examine the Holy One, the Enlightened One. They are people of great learning, brilliant brains out of our universities, and so forth and so forth. And they assume, therefore, that they have the qualification, the qualification, as well as other qualifications necessary, to recognize an enlightened one. And quaintly enough, they think they can examine him and write books upon him. And occasionally they write the book which pricks the bubble of Eastern or Western or Northern or Southern spirituality. They forget that they have immortalized themselves by their books as being still somewhat childish and ignorant of this transcendent realm of our being and the nature of transcendence itself. So one has to be very careful how one studies, because prior to the full fruition of this wisdom from within, this day which is the sun of enlightenment in the cloudless skies, prior to that there has to be study according to our particular stage. We have to use our intellectual power. So when one studies books, be very careful not to take the printed word as gospel. You know how people all over the world, they meet wherever they meet, in their homes or at the pub or in the club or at a meeting, and they talk and they say, "Oh, but I saw it in the papers the other day, the printed word, a gospel truth." We have that tendency. We all have that tendency. We take a book by someone who is regarded as an authority in his particular line. He undoubtedly is an authority in that line. But when that line happens to be the sphere of the infinite, the unknown, the immeasurable, the transcendent, we must always remember that that is something which cannot be seen or understood through the instrumentality of that which is finite and mortal. If we understand this, we can understand the meaning of faith in its true sense. We shall see that it has no relationship with mere belief. When, for example, the great religious, those who are concerned with spreading religious teachings say, "You must have faith in the Christ or in the Buddha or Zarathustra or Krishna or whoever it is or whatever it is. You must have faith." They say it, and the people understand it in terms of mere belief. It is very hard for them to appreciate the meaning of faith in terms of being touched by transcendence. A touching which can affect us and transform us permanently, provided we are free of beliefs and particular ideas and conditioned modes of thinking, feeling, and formulating. Here again, one may see another purpose of our being, our individual being. That this which is the infinite, the transcendent, the unlimited and illimitable, ultimately can manifest and function through the finite, the mortal, the conditioned, the limited. You see, what day can mean? For us ordinary human beings, in our complete fulfillment as humans, it's a tremendous meaning, and it is helpful to understand these meanings, because insofar as we do really understand them, they so inspire and change quite naturally and spontaneously the ordinary course of our daily life, that our living, our particular span, is made most worthwhile. Again, the term worthwhile means something utterly different from what the man of the world means by the term worthwhile. This fully enlightened state Samyak Sambuddha, as it is called in Buddhistic terms, is the state of constant communion. It is the state of pure faith. Now we understand we are beginning to understand something of the real meaning of having faith in any of the holy ones or in the truth which they presented in their teachings to people, the truth which they embodied and manifested, radiated out of their own being in their everyday life. You know how they say, have faith in the Buddha, or faith in Christ. And the mass of Buddhists or Christians think in terms of a person who was known as the Buddha, a person who was known as the Christ, or whoever he may be or is in our own day and age. Has little relation to that. There is a relationship. But when we know that relationship in its fullness, we too are enlightened beings. Religious beings come to fulfillment, not merely striving or seeking. With a striving or seeking which always is tainted by self-interest. We want freedom. We want truth. We want the bliss of nirvana, or the glory of the kingdom of heaven. We want. Which we? We don't know our immortal being. We only know the mortal being. And it is that mortal, finite, limited, imperfect being which wants. And it can want only in terms of the imperfect. Therefore, the curious and painful state of disturbance and sorrow in our human race. This fully enlightened state is represented in the Rig Veda. And I mention this because it shows how far back this was known. The Rig Veda is the oldest religious monument of the whole of the Indo-European race. It's our oldest treasure. It is represented there, personified in the so-called god Savitar, who is the sun by day as well as by night. You see the significance of it. Surya is the sun by day. Mitra is the sun by night. The sun by night is invisible to mortals, but to the Rishi, the true Maharishi, the barriers between day and night have been dissolved, and the light shines, this transcendent light shines throughout the day as well as throughout the night, shines through our conscious life as well as through our subconscious, unconscious life. And the veil between the conscious and the unconscious, commonly called unconscious in our own being, is completely removed, which means that the psyche, our own psyche, which is our own in the limited mortal sense, is so utterly purified, so utterly transparent, so utterly empty of thoughts, ideas, beliefs, and so on, that this universal mind functions freely through it. And for us, therefore, we are no longer under the tyranny of what in the ordinary worldly life the conscious mind holds and presents for us in conflict with the unconscious mind. This state is the complete and full samadhi of the yogi, of the religia, of the pure contemplative. I'm using different terms because we are not concerned with any one specialized presentation of religion, but of religion in its wholeness, in its depth. This too is the timeless state, the day-night state. I'm hyphenating the words day-night there. The day-night state in which there is only perpetual light. That, as far as I'm able to suggest, is the full meaning for us who are concerned with religion in its supreme sense of the word day. That's only part of the title of our theme. We shall consider the other part tomorrow.